Our collective nightmare, a stranger showed up on Facebook with a polished face, a story tuned to somebody's weaknesses, and a wardrobe of red Ferraris. That stranger convinced a 52-year-old man from Wallington, New Jersey, to hand over almost everything he had. The total was about $280,000, the life savings he scraped together after losing a job and during a divorce. Flushed into a glittering fake called crypto, and then gone, the contact began as casual sympathy over a post about safe food for a child with celiac disease. The stranger, using the name Eilis Danner, migrated the conversation from Facebook to WhatsApp and stitched together a whole life. Fashion shows, winter streets of Manhattan, a fluffy dog, a half-told tragedy about a lost child, an accent that sounded like belonging. The gestures were small and precise. Photos, voice notes, a single blurry video call that suggested presence but refused intimacy. The stranger mirrored details that made the stories believable, which is to say, terrifyingly easy. The scam fit a pattern now common enough to have its own name: pig butchering. Romance warms the mark, patience fattens the account, then the account gets slaughtered. Novak saw a few small withdrawals succeed, and with the optimism of a man who had already been crushed by life's ordinary cruelties, he kept feeding it. What started as a couple of thousand became a quarter of a million and then more. When he tried to take money out, the website demanded tens of thousands in fees, the profile vanished. The investment site blinked into error messages and then blank air. The dog, the dinners, the skyline, all images recycled under different names across the internet. This is not an accident. It is a system. Scammers harvest attention and grief, then convert both into untraceable wallets and offshore rails. They buy American phone numbers, assemble convincing backstories, and use a mix of fake accounts, recycled influencer images, and ever-better deepfake tricks to impersonate people. They hire real humans to keep the charade believable and deploy software to reflect fake balances like a video game. Experts tracing the transactions say the money flows across chains and countries, out of reach of ordinary recovery. Law enforcement collects files. He filed reports with local police and the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center. That process resembles paperwork for a catastrophe you already lost. There's a small, ugly moral. Loneliness is currency. The scam exploited more than a gap in cybersecurity. It exploited a gap in social safety nets, in stable work, in the small community checks that used to tip people off before they lost everything. A man who fixed ransomware at his old job is now reduced to reading mindfulness books and keeping a journal so his kids might someday understand what happened. He's trying to piece a life back together while the person who paraded the riches online resurfaces with new profiles and the same images intact. This story is a symptom and a forecast. Technology makes lying cheap and believable, finance makes losing catastrophic, and the social fabric that might have stopped it is threadbare. Victims become case files. Scammers become more sophisticated. The countries and platforms that should stop this shrug and pass links around like condolences, there is forensic work being done, and there are people trying to trace the money. There is also a simple, ruthless truth. Until we change the incentives on the platforms that spread these lies, on the financial rails that move illicit cash, on the social systems that leave people vulnerable, the nightmare will repeat. Meanwhile, people who tried to be decent, who reached for a hand in a dark time, will keep finding their hands empty. This is what we mean by collective. The terror is personal and universal at once, an ordinary life reduced to zeros on a screen while the images of wealth keep scrolling.
You ever notice how first world problems have started to look like archaeology with better lighting? There's a store in Alabama that exists solely to sell the stuff airlines give up on: unclaimed baggage, 50,000 square feet of other people's vacations, anxieties, and bad packing choices. It's a thrift shop, a museum, and the internet's wildest garage sale all rolled into one. People stroll in like it's a treasure hunt. A woman tries on a satin and lace wedding dress, admires the train, twirls, then puts it back because, get this, her boyfriend hasn't proposed yet. The dress has a more complicated relationship timeline than they do. Meanwhile, someone else's tux made it to the Oscars. Congratulations to Daniel Scheinert and to the person who misplaced Hollywood glam between gate C7 and D3. The inventory reads like a confessional: funeral casket key, a jar of shark teeth, two live rat snakes, a refurbished Hoggle puppet from Labyrinth, a custom Nikon built for the space shuttle, abandoned in transit, and then politely returned to NASA. There's romance, menace, and a small zoo all in aisle 7. Airlines try to reunite bags for a few months, then they sell the remains to this retail miracle. They pay compensation. The owner gets paid. We, as a society, get to shop for someone else's misfortunes at 20% to 80% off. It's capitalism with extra empathy. Not because you care, but because you like a deal. The store calls itself not a thrift store, fine. It's a museum of things people loved enough to pack for vacation and absent-minded enough to forget on the way. It's where Taylor Swift tour t-shirts meet vintage Gucci and someone's new AirPods. Fashion trends and existential crises both on clearance. People camp out overnight for the annual ski sale. They pitch tents to buy used ski boots that were once someone's weekend triumph, and then return to the wild retail ecosystem after the airline took out a check. One woman literally found her own lost ski boots there, engraved and everything. That's romance and bureaucracy colliding in the most southern way possible. There's a certain poetry to buying a stranger's life on discount. You're not rescuing anything, you're repurposing absence. It turns out loss can be profitable, festive, and weirdly communal. People line up to buy the consumer detritus of the modern traveler while glorifying their own ability to snag luxury for less. In the end, unclaimed baggage is a plain-spoken truth about affluence. We have so many problems they can be boxed, labeled, and resold. And when one person's misfortune becomes another's find, we all clap politely and call it adventure.
The Foreign Policy Playbook has been replaced by a social media broadcast and a conga line of warships. President Trump told airlines, pilots, and smugglers to treat Venezuelan airspace as effectively closed, using his preferred public megaphone. The FAA then issued a cautious memo saying it can't actually shut another country's skies, but maybe don't fly over there anyway. That's governance now, policy by post, followed by bureaucratic shrug. Behind the bluster sits a tidy logic meant to calm Americans, stop the drugs, stop the migrants. Behind that sits something blunter and more useful to power. Removing a leader and normalizing military options. The administration has declared Venezuela's government a terrorist organization. Greenlit CIA moves inside the country, massed warships, and 15,000 troops in the region under a name that sounds like a video game expansion. Land? Strikes were promised as imminent. A senator applauded. Casualties from interdiction operations have already mounted. Maduro answers with rituals of resistance, televised shows of force, and repeated vows of invincibility, while the state tightens at home. People get arrested for sharing dissenting messages on encrypted apps. The daily terror is quieter than explosions. It's the notification that your friend disappeared and the hum of Christmas carols in the same city that's under surveillance. There is surprising normalcy in the middle of it all. Stores run Black Friday ads. Cafes pour coffee. People try to live. That ordinary life acts as cover for extraordinary violence. Sanctions, covert operations, legal rebranding of an entire government as an enemy, and the piling up of military assets that make actual strikes easier to justify tomorrow than they are today. This is not a chain of mistakes. It's a series of deliberate escalations dressed as logistics and law enforcement. The rhetoric flips between threats and handshake offers. Back-channel calls happen, then the administration says talks are fine if they fit a timetable that includes an immediate exit for the president of another country. Diplomacy becomes a conditional convenience. Force becomes a planning document. Meanwhile, ordinary Venezuelans move between fear and fatigue. They imagine the worst, and continue with the next meal. That split, mundane consumption beside looming violence, is the template for modern empire in miniature. Treat a fractured nation like a supply route problem, announce closures on social apps, prepare the hardware, and expect life to go on for everyone except the toolbox you're using. The spectacle is instructive. It shows how easy it has become to turn global politics into a broadcast, a designation, and a logistics plan. It also makes clear how quickly familiar institutions, airlines, humanitarian groups, courts, media, get folded into a war by administrative notice. This is the slow motion part of the collapse. The normal things we rely on get repurposed as instruments of pressure, and the rest of us watch routine commerce continue while a country's sovereignty is negotiated like a freight tariff.
based on the article Final Destinations: What Happens When the Dead Go Traveling, reporting from Amsterdam about Mortuarium Schiphol. There's something beautifully efficient about airports. They move millions of us through narrow tubes of air, sell us duty-free perfumes, and panic in economy class. And tucked quietly behind a barbed wire fence is the part of that efficiency that refuses to be romantic. A full-service mortuary whose job is to make sure last travels arrive as planned. Think about that for a moment. We build machines to lift us above the world, then we build a building to receive the ones those machines can no longer carry. The mortuary at Schiphol is, in its own way, just another terminal. Only the queues end in paperwork, wax seals, and a circular skylight above a room where people try to make sense of final arrivals. We pick a life, we buy a ticket, and sometimes, left checks out mid-flight. The plane lands, an official knocks, a discreet vehicle pulls up. A body is rolled through a back exit and into refrigeration. Nobody sees it unless they want to. That's our compromise with dignity. Invisibility paired with cold, regulated order. There's bureaucratic comfort in that order. There are mortuary passports, hermetically sealed bags, black plastic wrap, and red wax stamps. There are manuals, embassies charging fees, translations that cost more than you paid for the souvenir magnet. We invent protocols for the moment every protocol fails to be poetic. We have a name for transporting bodies, repatriation of mortal remains, and we insure against it like it's a predictable travel inconvenience. Buy the policy, check the box, breathe a little easier until you don't. Still, humans insist on ritual. In a lounge with pitchers of water and pho, flowers, bands have trumpets and drums. Families wash the dead by hand, sing, laugh, and pour drinks. There's something riotous about honoring mortality with a party, an insistence that meaning can be baked into a practical municipal process. We wrap the world's final events in ceremonies, even if the coffin is poplar and the paperwork stamped in triplicate. And then there's the modern circus. TikTok clips that turn a mortuary into content, gawkers arriving because something on a screen told them to be curious. We commodify curiosity at the exact place where curiosity meets absence. The living watch, comment, like, and move on. After all, the algorithm demands a next glance. Maybe the strangest human trait is this. We treat death as a logistical problem to be solved with dignity. We make protocols and translations, we demand embalming rules and zinc-lined coffins, and we charge embassies for permission to close a chapter. We are absurdly persistent about structure in the face of an event that ultimately renders structure irrelevant. We refuse chaos with forms. There's no neat moral here, only the peculiar comfort that we can control some small things when the big thing refuses to be controlled. Mortuaries don't deny the absurdity of death. They appoint clerks to organize it, artists to design faux flowers for winter, and employees who answer the phone at 5 a.m. The world keeps moving, the flights keep landing, and the final destinations are handled with all the quiet bureaucratic care we can muster. It is, in its way, the last polite thing we do for each other. An acknowledgement that even endings deserve a proper gate.
The capitalist's fever dream. A city's lights go out and a boardroom lights up in Miami. Missiles and hundreds of cheap drones make a night of terror into a spreadsheet. Targets, downtime, repair costs, insurance claims. Ukraine's energy grid is hammered. Hundreds of thousands plunged in the cold and dark, while private companies tally how many families have power restored and how many shareholder questions they can dodge. The language of war becomes the language of service restoration and damage control. Human bodies are reduced to metrics. Washington's peace plan, drafted by an administration more comfortable with leverage than law, nearly read like an investment prospectus that favored the buyer. The draft alarmed Kyiv not because it was naive, but because it smelled of negotiation with domestic deals already inked. When the president's plan tilted toward Moscow, diplomacy turned into a triage of influence. A delegation from Kyiv flown across the Atlantic to meet in a Florida playground, where a senator, a Wall Street-adjacent developer, and a presidential son-in-law play diplomat and dealmaker. Politics and real estate sit shoulder to shoulder at the negotiating table. The public interest is habituated to being outsourced. The optics are blunt. A presidential envoy with a construction ledger, a financier with a Rolodex, and a career politician swap protocols while neighborhoods smolder. A chief of staff quits after a corruption raid and the government scrambles to steady the narrative, because scandal is an annoyance only until cameras start asking about bond markets and reconstruction contracts. Appointing a new lead negotiator becomes part crisis management, part portfolio reshuffle. Russia's barrage, dozens of missiles, almost 600, drones. targeted energy and civilian infrastructure with surgical predictability. Those are the things private capital loves to own after they break. Transmission lines, urban redevelopment, emergency contracts. Damage becomes opportunity once the smoke clears and the procurement process opens. The war economy is a marketplace disguised as geopolitics, and every blown window is a future invoice. The U.S. response is theatrical and transactional. Miami negotiations follow Geneva counterproposals and an expected trip to Moscow for U.S. envoys. The message is clear. Peace is negotiable, and so are the terms of rebuilding. Macron's meetings in Paris are framed as solidarity, but solidarity now shares the stage with feasibility studies and investment memos. Kyiv's suffering is a line item to be rationalized or capitulated to, depending on which balance sheet has louder shareholders. Meanwhile, ordinary people pick glass out of their faces and wait for power to come back because the private firm's update said 360,000 homes have been re-energized. The number reads like a press release. The human toll is reduced to a bullet point buried beneath financial optimism. Governments posture about dignified peace, as if dignity could be budgeted and outsourced. This is not just war. It's a market in which violence is a form of supply chain disruption, and diplomacy is a negotiation over who gets the contracts after the cranes arrive. The machinery of capitalism reframes catastrophe into commerce, and every broken city becomes a potential asset class. That is the fever dream. Destruction as opportunity, politics as deal-making, lives as collateral in a global auction.